KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump proposes that the U.S. will take over Gaza and doesn't rule out using U.S. troops. What would that mean for millions of Palestinians who live there? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. How could artificial intelligence change or warp democracy? I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. Two former tech executives and the late Henry Kissinger try to imagine how AI could go right or very wrong. Also, Secretary of State Marco Rubio is making his first official trip through Latin America. And if the cost of eggs is too damn high, we have some plant-based alternatives that you can try. It's Wednesday, February 5th. Two of the world's greatest soccer stars share a birthday. Cristiano Ronaldo is 40 and Neymar is 33.
Nice run.
News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump is suggesting that the United States take over Gaza and redevelopment as displaced Palestinians are relocated to other countries. Trump also said he envisioned Palestinians and others returning to the region once it's rebuilt. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports Palestinians are reacting to the idea.
29-year-old Bassam Muhammad Abdelrauf stands in the central square of Gaza City, once grand and now reduced to piles of rubble, after more than a year of war between Israel and Hamas. Still, he says he would never leave. Even if there was a place that was a million times better, I would still live among the rubble and the tents, he says. It's hard to describe my love for Gaza, my home, he adds. But for some, life in Gaza has simply become too hard. 30-year-old Yahya Barakat says he would leave if given the chance. My home is gone, my life is gone, my future is gone, he says. If I find a country that embraces me, provides me with safety, I'll go. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Tel Aviv, with reporting from NPR's Anas Baba in Gaza City.
More than 2 million federal workers are facing a deadline on Thursday to accept a deferred resignation offer. Some Democratic lawmakers are slamming the offer as illegal or a scam. Randy Irwin is the president of the National Federation of Federal Employees, which represents some U.S. government workers.
The kind of things that they have said they wanted, some 75% reduction in the federal workforce, cutting $2 trillion from the federal budget, those things are absolutely irresponsible. Impossible.
The deferred resignation offer is seen as a step toward removing many of the 2.3 million government employees in a White House effort to overhaul federal agencies. Stocks on Wall Street open lower this morning as the U.S. Postal Service backtracks on plans to block small package shipments from China. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow fell about 82 points in early trading.
The Postal Service says it will continue to deliver packages from China to addresses in the United States, lifting a hold that was imposed a day earlier. The goods in those packages may cost more, however. The Trump administration ordered a new 10% tariff on imports from China this week and says it will no longer exempt small dollar deliveries to individual customers, a loophole that had been exploited by some e-commerce companies in China. The Postal Service says it's working with customs officials on a way to collect those import taxes. Talks on a possible merger between Honda and Nissan appear to be stalled. The two Japanese automakers say they're exploring their options. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Earthquakes are continuing to shake the Greek island of Santorini. Authorities are stepping up their emergency plans in the event that the tremors lead to a larger quake in the coming days. Coast Guard vessels and a military landing craft have been dispatched in a wider region in the event that evacuations are ordered. Police in Sweden say 10 people were killed and at least 5 others were injured in a shooting on Tuesday. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports a gunman opened fire at an education center in the central part of the country.
Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson described the attack at an adult education center in the city of Örebro as the worst mass shooting in Swedish history. Police say the suspect is also dead and is believed to have acted alone. Police have warned the death toll could continue to rise as several people had been shot. The shooting occurred at a school for adult education, which is located on a campus where other schools, including those for children, are based. Scandinavian authorities have worked to crack down on gun violence over recent years, following an uptick in deadly gang-related shootings. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Copenhagen.
Nearly 50 million Americans from the Midwest to the Northeast could be in the path of a severe winter storm starting later tonight. Forecasters say the weather system is expected to bring ice and freezing rain that could make travel conditions dangerous in many regions. Stocks on Wall Street are continuing to trade lower at this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 161 points, the Nasdaq down 132. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Sony Pictures Classics, presenting I'm Still Here, a film by Walter Salles starring Fernanda Torres. A woman is forced to reinvent herself after her family suffers an injustice by the Brazilian government, now playing select cities.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C. A Wall Street Journal headline captures one of the ironies of this moment. The headline says, quote, Trump campaigned on ending foreign entanglements. Now he wants to own Gaza. So says the Wall Street Journal. The president did in fact talk of taking over the Palestinian territory, adding it to other proposed acquisitions such as Greenland, Canada, and the Panama Canal.
I don't want to be cute. I don't want to be a wise guy, but the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something that could be so bad. This could be so magnificent.
Removing 2 million Palestinians, more or less, and turning the area into seaside real estate development. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not exactly say no. He said it could change history. Trump's proposal would end hope of a Palestinian state, and Saudi Arabia, an important country here, has issued a statement saying that a two-state solution is non-negotiable. The countries that Trump would like to take in, Palestinians, say they won't do it. Palestinian reaction has been mostly hostile, although our colleague Aya Batraoui says some Palestinians might welcome the chance to leave. Let's get one more point of view about this from Yusuf Monair, who is a senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C. He leads the Palestine-Israel program and has commented on events in the region for decades. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
What did you think when you heard of this proposal?
Well, look, first thing you have to keep in mind is that prior to Trump's comments, I understood this as the meeting between a convicted felon in the White House and an indicted war criminal in Benjamin Netanyahu. So the expectation was there was going to be a conspiracy to commit further crimes once these two gentlemen got together. And of course, I wasn't surprised when I heard Trump's latest outrageous idea to not just ethnically cleanse the Gaza Strip, but to actually have the United States engage in the imperialist endeavor of annexing it and taking it over. So this is the newest outrage from Donald Trump, and not something that was completely surprising given who he was meeting with, what their respect for the law and rights actually is, given their track record, and his history of saying outrageous things.
I want to understand if you take the Israeli position seriously here. Trump has been talking for a number of days about cleaning out Gaza, his phrase. And we asked Danny Danon, the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, about this just on Monday. And he said Israel's policy is we don't want to take over Gaza and the Palestinians will remain there and we've got to find some way to govern. He wasn't talking about removing Palestinians at that time. This was a right-wing position, removing the Palestinians. Do you think that Benjamin Netanyahu is serious about pursuing this?
I think Benjamin Netanyahu is mostly interested in remaining in power in Israel. He heads a very precarious coalition that could collapse at any time. Remember, he presided over the single most disastrous security failure in Israeli history, and he's yet to really be held accountable for that by the Israeli public. What he is seeking to do is to really keep this war going on for as long as he possibly can so he doesn't end up facing the music. And if he can drag out the situation in Gaza for 5 years, 10 years, create a new set of challenges and problems that keep the the accountability towards him at a distance, he'd be happy to pursue that, whether it's through this crazy Trump idea or the next one.
I'd like to know what you think about one statement Trump made that a lot of people who might be skeptical of his proposal might sign on to. He argues that the current situation in the Middle East is not working, that it's untenable, that it's been a failure for 50 years, and so he'd like to shake it up by doing this. Would you agree that the current situation is unsustainable and that Gaza is, in fact, a disaster at this point?
Look, I think everybody in the region understands that, has understood that for a long time, but they also understand that the reason that is the case is because almost 8 decades ago, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from their homes during the creation of the Israeli state into surrounding countries. This has been the foundation of destabilization and conflict in the region for the better part of a century now. And the last thing that anyone in the region wants to sign up for or thinks is a path to stability is more ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. So Trump has obviously identified a problem here, but is really more like an arsonist than a firefighter.
Yusuf Munayyer is a senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, where he leads the Palestine-Israel program. Thanks for your opinions this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The Trump administration is telling all employees of the United States Agency for International Development to stop doing their jobs.
Yeah, the workers are told to go on administrative leave by Friday at 11:59 p.m., according to a new directive sent to agency staff globally and posted on the website. This comes after more than 2 weeks of chaos at the agency, as the president and Elon Musk said they were in the process of shutting it down.
NPR global health correspondent Fatma Tanis joins us now to tell us all about this. So who exactly signed off on this?
Well, it was a short note. It was not signed by any official, and it said that there would be some exceptions, that essential personnel expected to continue working would be notified by Thursday afternoon. Now, around 10,000 people work for USAID. Most of them are serving overseas, and they've been given 30 days to pack up and come back home. The note ended with the words, "Thank you for your service."
So what are you hearing from the people who work there?
Well, they're shocked and gutted. I spoke to several officials at the agency who didn't want to be named because they're not authorized to speak publicly. And they said that this is effectively a shutdown of the agency, and they called the process inhumane. Now, for staff who are overseas, there are other concerns. People have kids in school, spouses who have jobs, they have pets. It's going to be hard to uproot their lives in 30 days, and many are expecting the next step to be mass layoffs. I also heard concerns about what this means for the U.S. I spoke with Susan Reichle, a retired USAID official, and here's how she put it.
This is taking away a critical element of our national security, and it's affecting people's lives from not just a humanitarian perspective, but we're leaving a huge vacuum for China and Russia.
I mean, it seems like the Trump administration wants to get rid of this agency. Why would they want to do that?
Well, President Trump has been saying that USAID is too independent, that it is full of, quote, radical left lunatics, and that its programs are not in line with his America First policy. Now, people who work in the agency, they say their allegiance is to the Constitution and not to any political party. Many of them served under multiple administrations. And they say that everything they do down to the countries and the issues that they work on is approved by Congress. Now, since Congress chartered USAID, legal experts say the administration doesn't have the authority to abolish it on its own, but there are still a lot of questions about how this is going to play out.
And they've had programs all over the world, so what happens now to all of those things?
Well, for now, most programs receiving U.S. foreign aid have been halted. And you know, there are multiple disease outbreaks going on, Ebola in East Africa. There's a different hemorrhagic fever in Bolivia. These are part of USAID's work overseas. Here's Matt Kavanaugh, the director of global health policy at Georgetown University.
The USAID team was literally preparing to respond to these new outbreaks that occurred literally as the president was being inaugurated, and now that's stopped.
So have distributions of HIV medication, mpox vaccines, a therapeutic food for malnourished kids. Millions of people around the world aren't getting those services anymore.
All right, so a lot still up in the air. That's NPR's Fatma Tennis. Thank you very much for letting us know about all this.
Thank you.
All right, so Steve Inskeep, have you tried to buy any eggs recently?
Yes, I think I know where you're going with this, and I will just tell you that I'm a big egg eater. I'm an omelet guy. I love doing things with eggs, so yes.
Yeah,
yes.
And you've noticed that the prices are up.
Way up.
Here's the weird reason why. Okay, so to prevent bird flu, millions of chickens have been slaughtered each month, and that has meant that egg prices are soaring now, and that also means that grocery shelves are nearly empty.
Notice that. So what do you do if you can't find or can't afford a carton of eggs?
Glad you asked, because Leah Curran Moon, she owns DC Vegan. It's a plant-based deli and catering company. She says there are a lot of plant-based alternatives. In fact, her weekend brunch is egg-free.
What?
We make frittatas and omelets and scrambled eggs. And for those kinds of like really kind of egg-centric dishes, there's a really couple great options. The first is Just Egg, which is a product made with mung beans that you can find at the grocery store.
It's not bad, Steve. I've had it.
Okay.
Since I've gone like vegan, you know, yeah. It sounds, yeah, I know.
Okay.
But it's, yeah.
Sure.
Now, another option is tofu.
And that really mimics like a scrambled egg really, really well.
Yeah, just add plenty of spices, salt, pepper, and turmeric to give that tofu that yellow
okay,
color.
Fine. I mean, tofu is fine, but no foo. I want eggs.
No foo. Now, okay, now what about baking without eggs?
Well
Curran says, Curran Moon recommends an egg replacer.
That's just potato starch and tapioca, and that you cannot tell a difference in your baking when you're using that product. So you can use that for baking. You can use it for binding if you're kind of breading and frying something. The potato starch egg replacer is perfect.
Now, there's another go-to, and that's flax meal.
So if you just take flax seeds and grind them up, 1 teaspoon of flax meal plus a tablespoon of water equals 1 egg.
Just the flax, ma'am. I knocked you aside tonight. You're done.
Yeah, you're right. Just the flax. Now, Curran Moon suggests trying applesauce or maybe even mashed banana as egg alternative, something called aquafaba.
Aquafaba is just the water from a can of chickpeas, and you can use that to whip up and turn into a meringue or use it for egg-based cocktails.
Well, thank goodness, because I'm going to need a cocktail after all this discussion of doing without eggs.
I mean, that's a great like advertising possibility for Awkwafina, the comedian. Awkwafina pitching for Aquafaba.
Okay, egg alternatives. Finish out.
That's egg on my face. This is NPR News. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, one of Pete Hegseth's first actions as defense secretary was to declare the end of the DEI era. A serious problem the military is facing, though, is a severe shortage of recruits. We'll talk about why, how the military is attempting to reverse the trend, and how vulnerable to attack we've become with Dexter Filkins of The New Yorker. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A book about artificial intelligence includes some history from centuries before computers. Spanish conquistadors landed in present-day Mexico in the 1500s, and the ruling Aztecs were a little too welcoming. According to the story, the Aztec emperor met the Spaniards, then took their advice, then became their hostage, and finally they took over. Having told this story, the book asks, could AI do that to us? Could we let it take over? Or even mistake it for God? Two former big tech executives wrote this book, Eric Schmidt of Google and Craig Mundy of Microsoft, along with the statesman Henry Kissinger. Schmidt told me that Kissinger thought deeply about AI before his death at age 100.
He was interested, since he turned maybe 93 or 94, in artificial intelligence, not in a technical matter, but rather in terms of its impact on society. He had studied Kant and the meaning of reality before all of us were born.
The book, called Genesis, asks how the rapid spread of AI will affect humanity.
The tech people make these decisions unilaterally, and they do it without understanding the deep societal impact of their tools.
Eric Schmidt himself is a longtime tech person who, of course, follows the tech news. He spoke with us just after the new announcements of Chinese chatbots suggested another leap in AI's impact. We also spoke after the recent U.S. election, where voters faced ever more sophisticated high-tech marketing. That story in Schmidt's book about Aztecs losing control to a new arrival is in a chapter asking what happens as AI works its way into politics.
It's perfectly possible that artificial intelligence systems will become the great addiction machines and the great persuaders. So you have a unprincipled politician who just decides to promise everything to everyone and then has AI build messages that are targeted to each individual individually. Does it ultimately produce despots who have these communications techniques, or do the systems ultimately say that's true and that's false? So far, we've not figured that out.
You talk about philosopher kings, the ancient idea of like a wise ruler who tells everybody what to do, which is a concept, of course, that has never worked out because everybody's a human being and ends up making mistakes or being corrupt. But the concept is out there. And you seem to run a kind of thought experiment of what if we ended up letting artificial intelligence be our philosopher king? Where are you going with this?
The idea there is to say the following. Artificial intelligence should ultimately be able to follow reasoning better than humans. So let's imagine you take an AI system and you give it a constitution. It could be a wise king in the sense that it would be fair and even against the constitution that it is given. The key question there, of course, is who writes the Constitution?
Hopefully, people would still be the ones to instruct these super rational governing machines. But Schmidt doubts we really understand the technology well enough to use it properly. His co-author Kissinger foresaw worse outcomes as computers grow more powerful.
Either people will develop it into a religion,
which doesn't sound good,
or they'll fight a war against it,
which sounds like the plot of the Matrix movies.
To the degree that the AI systems begin to limit your freedom of motion and of speech, it's a problem.
Because people value freedom.
Human societies have compromises. We allow for deviance. We allow for certain mistakes, but not others. If you wrote the perfect computer to tell people what to do, the people would revolt.
How much do leaders of Silicon Valley, all of whom, or virtually all of whom you must know, think about these issues as they're developing their technologies?
They do think about it, but they don't get it right. And the reason they don't get it right is because these are issues that are broader than just business or technology or even customers. These are really social and moral questions. Companies are doing what companies do. They're trying to maximize their revenue. They're trying to keep their customers happy. They're trying to invent new things. It needs oversight. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the government pounding on them, but there has to be a consensus of what's right and what's wrong.
When you conduct these thought experiments, it causes me to think about the sector of people in the tech world who seem less and less interested in democracy or don't think it can work. Do you think that the advances of technology are turning some of your fellow tech people against democracy itself?
I think this may be unrelated to the advances of technology. These are just differences of points of view. Having spent a lot of time in countries that are run by the equivalent of dictators or authoritarian, democracy is imperfect. But freedom is important. It's really important that the AI systems promote more freedom, more action, more agency for adults.
What did you think about the other day at the presidential inauguration when tech leaders who have so much money at their command and are working with such powerful technology were on the same stage as the most powerful political leader in the world?
Well, to some degree, I was proud of my industry and impressed with my friends. On the other hand, I was concerned that there is a line that it's important business not cross. I would like our country to be run by our political leadership. And there's always a question of crossing that line. I worked very, very closely with President Obama, but I knew where the line was.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about the idea of the separation of powers, which is a part of American government. And of course, there's no formal separation in the Constitution between business leaders and the government. But that's essentially what you're saying, that there shouldn't be all that power in one set of hands or a few sets of hands.
Everyone would love to have all the problems solved by a single, very, very smart leader. Every political campaign is, I can go and fix all the problems ahead of you. But that's not how our country works. The genius of America is that it's not really under control. The genius of America are the 50 states and all of their different innovations, the different points of view. It's a tolerant society in terms of culture and race and backgrounds. The immigration components are really important. All of us are pretty much from somewhere else. If you look at what's happening everywhere else in the world, China's in a deflation, Europe is not growing, India is growing but very complicated, and you have America. I prefer America.
Eric Schmidt is the co-author with Craig Mundy and the late Henry Kissinger of Genesis, Artificial Intelligence, Hope, and the Human Spirit. Pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And we'll note here that Schmidt's Family Foundation has donated to NPR, and we cover them like anybody else. This is NPR News.
Irish poet Padraig O'Tooma spends a lot of time thinking about other people's poetry. In a new anthology, he brings us 44 poems about the pleasure and pain of relationships.
I was curious about how it is that poetry could speak to all kinds of experiences of the human condition.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, poet Padraig O'Tooma, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Reaction in the Middle East and Europe has been largely negative to President Trump saying the U.S. should take over Gaza and redevelop it. As NPR's Lauren Frayer reports from London, diplomats from Britain, France, Spain, and Ireland say they're worried about what that would mean for Palestinians.
British Foreign Secretary David Lammy says he wants to see a two-state solution with Palestinian sovereignty in the West Bank and Gaza.
We must see two states. We must see Palestinians able to live and prosper in their homelands.
Lammy told reporters that rather than the U.S. redeveloping Gaza, the U.K. wants to collaborate with Arab countries.
We will play our part, working alongside the Palestinian Authority and alongside Gulf and Arab partners.
Many of those countries have also rejected Trump's Gaza plan. Lammy was speaking to reporters during a visit to Ukraine, where he pledged nearly $70 million in additional aid to that country. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Trump announced the idea at yesterday's White House news conference alongside Israel's prime minister. The U.S. Postal Service now says it is accepting all inbound mail and packages from China and Hong Kong, reversing a suspension announced after President Trump enacted tariffs on goods imported from China. This is NPR News. The Senate has confirmed Pam Bondi to be the nation's next attorney general. The vote was 54-46. Democratic Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania joined Republicans in support of the former Florida Attorney General. A new study looks at polar bears and why their fur doesn't freeze. Here's NPR's Jonathan Lambert.
Most mammalian fur freezes when it gets wet in cold temperatures. Think human beards on a frosty winter day. But polar bear fur doesn't really freeze. That ability likely stems from high levels of ice-resistant compounds in their fur grease, according to recent research in the journal Science Advances. The study also found that polar bears' greasy fur lacked a compound called squalene, which sticks to ice and is found on most other marine mammals. The researchers hope the work could lead to more environmentally friendly alternatives to some anti-ice materials in ski waxes, as well as new kinds of de-icing fluid for aircraft. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Nearly $1.4 billion in legal bets are expected to be placed on Sunday's Super Bowl. That's according to the casino industry trade group, the American Gaming Association, which says that would break last year's record. The Kansas City Chiefs and the Philadelphia Eagles will face off in New Orleans in Super Bowl 59. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 31 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. The Trump administration has started sending migrants from the United States to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
The first plane load arrived yesterday. White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt gave this reason.
President Trump is not messing around, and he's no longer going to allow America to be a dumping ground for illegal criminals from nations all over this world.
The president has said he wants to make room for 30,000 migrants at Guantanamo.
NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has been talking with some lawyers who question the legality of that plan. So how many people have been sent there so far?
The U.S. has not released an official figure, but it appears to be a small number, possibly just one flight with about a dozen migrants on board. The Department of Homeland Security says they're all members of a Venezuelan organized crime group called Tren de Aragua, and overnight it released photos of handcuffed men in gray sweatpant outfits, some with neck tattoos, being led onto military planes. And several hundred U.S. service members were deployed to Guantanamo in the past few days to prepare for these arrivals.
And where are they going to be held in Guantanamo?
The U.S. says they will not be housed alongside the accused foreign terrorists held at the military prison there. Instead, Guantanamo's U.S. naval base has had a detention facility used for migrants intercepted at sea, usually Haitians and Cubans. It's had that for years, but it's been mostly empty for a long time. It's not ready for large numbers of people. So the military has also circulated photos of service members putting up green army tents to help with what it's calling a migrant operations center expansion. And the defense secretary says migrants will be held at Guantanamo only temporarily until the U.S. finds other countries to take them.
Okay. Now to the legality question, I mean, can the Trump administration legally send migrants from the U.S. to Guantanamo? Can they do that?
I've gotten conflicting answers from lawyers. Some say yes, some say no. One who thinks it is not legal is a lawyer at UCLA named Ahilan Arulanatham. He says U.S. immigration law dictates where these migrants can be sent. And if Cuba has presumably not agreed to take them, he says it's an illegal deportation. But Steve Lodick at Georgetown Law School thinks it's legal. He argues a deportation is not official until the U.S. has relinquished custody of the migrants, and that won't happen until they're moved to another country after being at Guantanamo. But you know that they disagree, suggests we're in murky legal territory. Vladek also thinks the Trump administration is sending migrants there as a kind of macho performance art. Here's Steve Vladek.
All you're doing this for is the symbolism, to be able to say, look, I moved these folks from the detention center across town to Guantanamo. It's all like very, very expensive flash with very little substance.
So we mentioned symbolism. I mean, what symbolism is there by sending migrants to Guantanamo?
You know, he points out it would be cheaper and easier to hold them somewhere in some big open space elsewhere in the U.S. But by shipping them to Guantanamo, you send a certain message. Here's how the editor of the website Lawfare, Ben Wittes, put it.
Are you using this facility because it has the stain of the name Guantanamo? And of course, the answer is yes. That's exactly why he's attracted to it. He's attracted to it for the same reason that it repels human rights groups.
And by the way, all those people I interviewed are skeptical that 30,000 migrants will ever end up at Gitmo, given the legal questions plus financial, political, practical barriers. But even sending a handful is getting a ton of public attention, which is part of the point.
Yeah, NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, has been traveling in Central America. Says he wants the United States to be a good partner. He's also delivered warnings to Panama about President Trump's bid to take over part of their country and has been answering questions about the administration's bid to dismantle the U.S. International Development Agency. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has been watching the way that Rubio has managed all this.
Looking out over a mountain-rimmed lake in El Salvador, Secretary Rubio seemed in his element, speaking in Spanish with someone he calls a friend, President Nayib Bukele. Off in the distance, a boat with Bukele's cheering fans sailed by.
90% approval rating.
Bukele points out that he has a huge approval rating. He's popular both in El Salvador and in Trump circles for his harsh crackdown on gangs. Now he's offering to help the U.S. by taking back illegal immigrants who are gang members and criminals, not just from El Salvador, but anywhere in the world, even U.S. citizens. Secretary Rubio told reporters later it was a great offer.
Obviously, we'll have to study it on our end. There are obviously legalities involved. We have a constitution. We have all sorts of things, but it's a very generous offer. No one's ever made an offer like that. And to outsource at a fraction of the cost, at least some of the most dangerous and violent criminals that we have in the United States.
Working with countries in this region to stop illegal migration has been a key theme of his trip. So too has U.S. foreign assistance, which has been put on hold in most parts of the world.
I have long supported foreign aid. I continue to support foreign aid. But foreign aid is not charity. It exists for the purpose of advancing the national interest of the United States.
Rubio says he's issuing waivers to make sure programs on security and migration continue in the countries he's visiting, including Panama, Costa Rica, Guatemala, and the Dominican Republic.
Every dollar we will spend as long as I'm Secretary of State, and as long as President Trump is in the White House, is going to be a dollar that's advancing our national interest.
All week, Rubio's been defending the administration's moves to dismantle the U.S. Agency for International Development. Salvadoran President Bukele complained on social media about democracy and human rights funding coming from USAID and said cutting that would be a big win. Rubio says he doesn't plan to lecture allies about human rights and will treat them better, but other partners in the region have faced tariff threats from President Trump. And Panama, the first stop on this five-country visit, has faced demands to give back the Panama Canal. Secretary Rubio didn't answer questions when he visited the canal, but he later described his talks with Panama's president as frank and good.
Look, he's a friend of America. He is. He's a friend of America. Panama is a strong partner and ally of the United States.
But he says the U.S. is concerned that Chinese companies control strategic ports along the canal.
When we turned over the canal, we turned it over to Panama. We didn't turn it over to China.
Rubio says he came away from his talks feeling good about the discussion, but says these issues will take time to resolve. Whether that will be enough for his boss is another question. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, with the secretary in Guatemala City.
Thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition. We know you get information from a lot of sources, and our commitment, what makes NPR different, is we're trying to bring you reliable information and show it. Prove what we say, challenge officials to prove what they say, and give you the context to understand if they don't. We also commit to coming back tomorrow to keep trying, because the world is a complicated place. You never learned it all at once. This is NPR News.
The death of several skaters in last week's crash over the Potomac River brought back painful memories of another tragedy decades ago. That's next time on Here and Now.
Did you know you can access the world of public radio? The latest news, standout podcasts, captivating stories, just by speaking? Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Good morning, Amy Martinez. The Goonies never say die, and they never forget their own. Four decades after the 1985 film about kids who follow a pirate map into an underground cavern, the cast reunited at Grauman's Chinese Theater in L.A. for a hand and footprint ceremony. They celebrated Ki-Hui Kwan, the actor who played the gadget whiz Data. Kwan said the tradition of placing his prints in the theater's famous cement slabs fulfilled a crazy dream. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm A. Martinez. As President Trump floats America taking control of Gaza and rebuilding it, more exchanges of Israeli hostages and Palestinian detainees are planned this weekend. One of those released last weekend is an American. Keith Siegel is getting a taste of life as a free man after 484 days in the hands of the Palestinian militant group Hamas. NPR's Jerome Sokolovsky spoke to Siegel's brother about how he survived captivity.
A man with a short white beard and a gentle demeanor sits in the lobby of the Ichilov Hospital in Tel Aviv. It was here that Lee Siegel was reunited with his 65-year-old younger brother last Saturday.
We're still getting used to the idea that I walked through those doors and he's back.
Lee recalls the moment Keith's daughters first saw him and sang, "Here comes our father." And then, with their mother, Aviva, the family embraced. At that moment, Lee Siegel had no words.
But seeing him hugging the children and hugging Aviva in the hospital, just joy and love.
Keith Siegel and other hostages released since the ceasefire in Gaza last month have not spoken in public. But some family members have started to pass along bits and pieces of what their loved ones went through. There are stories of desolation and suffering, but also of strength and resolve.
Keith is exceptionally resilient.
And he has an amazing memory, his 7 years older brother says. He never lost track of which day it was, where he was, or whom he was with. Speaking was not allowed, so Lee says his brother would have conversations in his mind.
He would talk to me, he would talk to our sons, he would talk to Aviva, he would talk to their children, he would talk to his sister-in-law, Aviva's twin sister.
And other people he cared about. Lee says Keith spent long periods in isolation, and he got moved around a lot. All this while Israel and Hamas were at war, and deprivation and destruction in Gaza were widespread. Wherever Keith was taken, there was no electricity, and food was scarce. He lost a lot of weight.
And when I hear people say that he looks frail and he's pale, I want to scream out loud. He's almost 500 days a hostage in Gaza. Of course he's frail. Of course he's pale.
On top of that, he was taunted, told his kibbutz and Israel no longer exist. Later in the war, Keith Siegel picked up snippets of news here and there. He realized the taunts were false, and he saw Israelis and people around the world calling for the hostages to be freed.
He's flabbergasted by the fact that so many people were so active outside of Israel, trying to push and open whatever doors we could open.
Lee says his brother is still trying to wrap his head around his transformation from subjugation to celebrity.
President Trump wants to speak with me? He wants to speak with me?
But one thing his brother says he is sure of, although his family wants him to focus on his recovery, Keith Siegel wants to find out what he can do to help the remaining 79 hostages return. Jerome Sokolovsky, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Thank you.
reversal on shipping e-commerce packages from China, although the new tax stays.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is currently looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who are interested in building a career and joining an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And by Rubrik, dedicated to giving businesses the power to bounce back fast when cyber attacks target the cloud. More at Rubrik.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. We had been reporting this morning about the U.S. Post Office suspending package deliveries from China and Hong Kong, potentially affecting American customers of e-commerce sites like Temu and Shein. But the suspension ended hours after it began. The Postal Service now says it will continue deliveries while trying to figure out how to collect new tariffs the Trump administration has now placed on those personal-sized purchases. Marketplace's Nova Safo is here with more.
Yeah, David, talk about whiplash, right? The U.S. Postal Service's announcement about the suspension, it said it would take effect this morning. It's already over. This has to do with the so-called de minimis exemption. Anything under $800 comes into the country without tariffs. Well, President Trump's new tariff policy on China, which went into effect yesterday, got rid of that exemption for Chinese retailers and shipments from Hong Kong, little personal shipments. And those retailers, especially Temu and Shein, have relied on de minimis to sell stuff really cheaply directly to Americans. After Trump's new China tariffs kicked in, the Postal Service suspended package deliveries from China and Hong Kong, presumably to figure out how to implement those tariffs. And now the Postal Service reversed itself.
All right. So doing it again, now this doesn't resolve just how they're going to put the import tax on the low-cost purchases.
Right. It removes the immediate prospect of disruption and delays, but the Postal Service says it's going to work with Customs and Borders Protection to figure out how to collect tariffs, you know, in the long term to meet this tariff requirement. This is new territory for the Postal Service. Long-term tariffs could mean costs will rise for consumers who are shopping on these ultra-low price sites, but, you know, it's not for certain. The de minimis exemption could end up being something that Shein and Temu are able to work around.
All right, we shall see. Nova, thank you. In the second hour of trading here, the Dow is little changed. The S&P is down 0.2%. The NASDAQ, I see, is down 0.5%. The ADP payroll company is part of an outfit that counts up the number of people getting paychecks each month, and the economy added 183,000 more people in January. This points to continued strength in the labor market. The big hiring and unemployment reports come on Friday. Stock in the big data analytics company Palantir rose a dramatic 24% yesterday after its CEO briefed investors that changes brought by cost cutters led by Donald Trump advisor Elon Musk could bring Palantir lots of new government business. Palantir was co-founded by Silicon Valley tycoon Peter Thiel, with whom Musk has had a sometimes friend, sometimes enemy business relationship that has spanned decades. Thiel was also an early backer of now Vice President Vance's political career.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Glassdoor. Adam Grant has joined the Glassdoor community with expert advice on finding a job and making the most of work life, all on the Glassdoor app. And by Clear Channel Outdoor, an out-of-home billboard company harnessing innovation and technology to connect advertisers with consumers. Billboardsforbusiness.com.
Now to inspiration versus appropriation, key to Black History Month. Let's look at a big Elvis Presley hit and the performance by a black artist that preceded it. These are themes from a new book called Before Elvis, The African-American Musicians Who Made the King. The author, Preston Lauterbach, joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
I had to throw away all my LPs some years ago before a move. I only have 25 of the Dearest Ones. And here's Big Mama Thornton right here in this pile. She's Hound Dog years before Elvis Hound Dog.
Everybody knows that song, Hound Dog, right? I mean, I think that's as well known the world over as any piece of music. Most people, I would say probably 90% of those people, identify with Elvis's version.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Big Mama cut it 3 years before Elvis is one of those kind of, interesting moments for a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, it had, I would say, more edge.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. It's snooping on the door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Preston, what does everybody say? Force of nature? I mean, that's usually the phrase that gets attached to Big Mama Thornton.
such a powerful vocalist and so gifted transmitting emotion, you know, through the little subtleties and inflections of a vocal. And I think that that's something that Elvis really responded to.
Now, her version, recorded in 1953, did sell. I mean, I saw one figure, about 500,000 copies, but she would continue to say she didn't make much money off that.
Well, look, the estimates on those sales vary. If you ask her record company, it sold 500,000. If you ask Big Mama Thornton, it sold 2 million. So the record companies were in the habit of depressing some of their totals, you know, for their own financial reasons.
Now, Big Mama Thornton remained grumpy her whole life about the amount of money someone like Elvis made off of Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog and what she made on her first version.
Big Mama was not the songwriter on Hound Dog. She was not the copyright holder or the publishing rights holder. She was the recording artist. So if you take that 178 RPM record that was issued in 1953, one of which was in Elvis's personal collection, I might add. For each one of those sold, she was entitled to the grand sum of a half of a penny per her arrangement with her record company.
Big Mama Thornton speaking out got the discussion about appropriation into the wider culture. I mean, had some benefits for her. When Janis Joplin does Ball and Chain, right? Some of that goes back to her.
Well, that's where the ownership of the material comes in and where the cash flow begins. And so it dates back to this really archaic way the music business operated during sheet music publishing. The publisher was the manufacturer of the product and therefore entitled to the first cash flow that came in. Well, the same thing was true of records. And so to bounce back to Ball and Chain a little bit, she assigned the publishing to this company because it was quote unquote standard procedure, which all you young musicians out there really need to question.
Preston Lauterbach's new book is called Before Elvis, The African-American Musicians Who Made the King. Mr. Lauterbach, thank you.
It has been my pleasure.
In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a red hot hoochie coocher. She was the roughest, toughest, frail, but Minnie had a heart as big as a whale. Hide, 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 hide,
hide, hide, hide, hide.